This is the DJ Spider Podcast, presented by BeatSource.
Let's do this. It's the DJ Spider Podcast, presented by BeatSource. And today, we got a legend in the game, okay? I don't use that lightly. This person, we've been friends, I don't know, it has to be almost 18 years now, or something like that. He's done it all, okay? You're about to find out what this man has done. He's been in many sides of the DJ game, things you may not know and things you do know, but he is a veteran and he's still killing it, and he's one of the dopest DJs ever. Give it up for Graham Funky.
Do you find these intros to be awkward?
Yeah, sometimes. Well, we've changed it. So I used to, in the previous iteration of the podcast, I would do a whole organized intro, and now we're just on and we're talking. And
just riffing.
If you want to look in the written out bio part of our podcast, you're going to see all his stuff, all his links. But for now, you're going to get to know him through his voice and his personality.
This is very funny.
So, welcome to the show. You're the first guest that's ever walked to the podcast.
Indeed.
So that shows how rich you are, because we're in a very rich neighborhood. Graham Funky, so happy to
I'm happy to be here. I like chopping it up with you.
Yes, yes. I'm excited to chop it up with you. So, yes, we have known each other in the LA DJ scene for a while now. And I think when I kind of came into this and discovered who DJ AM was and people like that, I had never been to like bottle service clubs and stuff like that. And I was immediately pointed to like, oh, go to this place, go to that place. There's this guy Stone Rock. There's this guy Graham Funky. And they're amazing DJs, you know, go check them out. And I went to see you guys and just my mind was absolutely blown of just your ability to mix such an eclectic mix of stuff. It was the very beginning of Serato, and put it all together and just get the crowd going crazy. Songs I had no idea what they were, your own custom edits and stuff like that.
I feel like maybe we met at Tokyo and you and Steve Wonder and Tina T had shown up. I think it's okay. Where we first met. And that was like me and Stone's vanity night. It was a Monday night. We would have dinner before and then we would just kind of like, it was really off the cuff. The venue let us do that and people would come to see just some different stuff. Not that we weren't playing different stuff anyway, right. But like that was really jazz. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
In terms of like the programming.
Yes, totally. You know what? You have a better memory than I do. And I think you're right. That is what, that was the spot. And then, but you were DJing like every night in LA at that point.
7 nights a week. Yeah.
Literally 7 nights a week. I mean, and you were doing, I mean, I think you gave me probably my first or one of my first gigs in like a Hollywood kind of club with bottle service at 40 Deuce.
Oh, okay. So I hired you at 40 Deuce.
Yes.
Okay.
You were the music director at 40 Deuce, and I had met you a little before, and I think AM had like given me the cosign, and I won the Mark Ronson contest, and so I had a little bit of credibility, but like—
Yeah, that 40 Deuce was such a dope club, and I some people will remember it, obviously, and others won't.
It was a burlesque club.
But it had DJs, and in fact, like, for February, they're doing like a revival, like they're back.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, for some people, you might remember from like the pilot episode of Entourage. It's like the only club that they name drop in the episode.
You're right. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that too.
And it was just like such a dope spot. And then, I mean, that's how I went to Vegas. I went to Vegas with Ivan Kane, having worked at the LA 40 Deuce. And then I went to Mandalay Bay with him. And
right.
That starts whole other chain of events, you know?
Oh my God. All right. We got to get into that. But in LA, you would do 40 Deuce. It was a crazy experience as a DJ because you had to do these tiny, 20 minute power sets.
That's a great question.
In between the burlesque dancers. And you were up in this booth kind of looking over this small club, but that was just absolutely packed with people drinking and watching this amazing burlesque show that would keep coming on.
Yeah, and it was like the clientele was like super
Hollywood.
Like high profile.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Very high profile Hollywood. Like, you know, I had not really been in anything like that, you know, and I remember going there and then AM's Club LAX.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of, you know, I'd been DJing 10 years, but I hadn't seen stuff like that, you know.
Yeah. You know, I mean, bottle service starts to come in sometime in the early 2000s, but it wasn't that wasn't defining the nightlife in LA, yeah. you know, until a point, you know,
right.
where people realized they could make some real money doing it. Prior to that, I think it was out of convenience, you know, not to have to wait for drinks.
Yeah.
Yeah, it changed the culture, obviously. You know,
right.
if you're old enough to remember, you can see that. If you're younger, you're going to be like, it wasn't always like this.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. And you – so what spots were you doing around that time? This was, what, 2006, maybe 2005?
Well, six, I'd already started Vegas. So anything I was doing in L.A. was –
probably 2005 or maybe even 2004.
Yeah. So I started Vegas in 2004. That's when a bunch of us from L.A. had gone out there. AM had gone out to Body English. Stone was working at the Palms. Vice was working at Body English. And then I went out with Ivan Kane at 240 Deuce. But prior to that, I mean, yeah, so like any LA work at that point was just to, you know, work in my hometown. So we were doing like Area.
Yes.
Like Green Door.
Right.
You know, spots like this. Again, you know, like maybe not everybody remembers those spots or not. Area becomes such a multitude of
now it's a Nightingale or something, right?
It was Greystone for a while, but prior to that, I think it was the Gate, which is like old school 80s and 90s club, you know?
Wow,
I think that's what it was. And it was Prey gets mentioned in Entourage too, you know? Like it was, it was Prey prior to being Area,
right? And it was, it's been a lot of iterations. Yeah. I mean, including all the clubs in LA. I mean, that's the way it goes. Everywhere you go, you're like, this used to be this, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
There was the My House, My Apartment
that
days.
That was
and
called
all
Garden of Eden for like a million years.
Right,
you know?
Garden
like
of Eden.
My whole time like coming up, it was Garden of Eden.
Right.
And then it became, it was my, I can't even remember. There's been so many iterations of these things that who can keep it straight? And no one's paying it, like no one's like documenting this.
Yeah.
You know, this will be lost in the annals of history at some point.
Right. Well, I just remember when I met you, like I think, you know, I'm doing these gigs in like a bar in Santa Monica for like, I'm getting $150. And I feel like you were in Hollywood. You had like a dope apartment. Like you took me to like a penthouse, you know.
Called that the Liberace starter kit, that condo. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
The Liberace starter kit apartment.
Yeah. It was all marble and mirrors.
Doheny and Sunset or something.
No, it was Hollywood Boulevard.
Hollywood Boulevard. Okay.
Yeah, I still have that place.
You do?
Yeah.
Amazing. That's so good to hear. And I just remember you talking to me about money too, which I know a lot of DJs don't talk about, but you were like, I forget what you said. I mean, you always have some good sayings, but it was something about like, I've made more money than some other. It was just something about like the fact that you were making a full living off DJing to me was like, this is incredible. Like I'm trying to do this and you're working every night, you're doing this and you're doing, to me, like any DJs that worked in clubs were like douchey and sucked, you know, but then I get to see you, Stone, AM, Vice, and all these people. And I'm like, oh my God, there's a whole world that I didn't know about.
I think most of us were pretty surprised that you could at some point call it a living.
Right.
Whereas it was pocket money for a long time for a lot of people. I think it's not just that you get to, maybe now it's different, but back then it's not like you got to this stage and suddenly like, okay, now I can make money doing this. There was literally like a paradigm shift where they were like, okay, now you can make money doing it.
Right. Was that Serato? It's almost like, it seems like Serato definitely gifted a lot of people a full career of DJing, you know, when they weren't.
It was a bunch of stuff, honestly. I mean, I got the Mandalay Bay contract prior to Serato. I was still like flying to Vegas with flight cases full of vinyl, you know what
Crazy.
I mean? And we started like duplicating the crates so we could leave them in Vegas. AM did the same thing at Body English and he had his two crates that stayed
duplicating
in
the crates as in buying double records or
going
quadruple
after,
records
yeah,
and
so
leaving
like,
it in Vegas
yeah, like
and
mirroring, LA. Mirroring your crates that you would carry. You would just leave, there was just like standard records that you knew you were going to play.
Yeah.
So then leaving them. So I would leave crates at 40 Deuce because I knew I was going to play them. And then
what you'd travel
with was whatever you wanted to like mix into that set or whatever was new single. So the bigger contracts started coming prior to Serato. Now, Serato was a curse and a blessing because one, you didn't have to fly with records, like actual records. And instead of having 400 songs to choose from, you could have 20,000 songs to choose from. The flip side is now everybody thinks they can DJ because they have iTunes, right?
Right.
So they didn't spend any time learning how to, you know, to DJ. And like and when I say learn how to DJ, I'm talking about the technical aspect, but I'm also talking about the psychological aspect, being in front of a crowd and like learning what works, how to manipulate a crowd, And so now they have a record collection, quote unquote, and they think they can go in front of a crowd. Well, you don't have that experience, like figuring out mob mentality, right?
It's so true. I'm always saying that, like, the psychology factor is so huge and people don't take that into account. They're like, what do you have planned out? Or, you know, it's like, I'm looking at everyone and moving at all moments, trying to figure things out, you know?
I've always said, like, the real job of DJing is just creating a dialogue with the people in front of you. And that's it. I mean, that is what you're there to do.
That's true.
And in terms of, like, what songs you're going to play, you're trying to determine what to play and when to play it in order to get to maximize the reaction, right? So that's what it is. It's not just like, even if you gave someone like the top 100 songs and put them in front of a crowd, it doesn't mean that the party's going to go off, right? Because you have to like navigate.
Yeah.
So Serato, on the one hand, yes, I was happy to have certain songs. Like as an example, like if a celebrity would come in and you wanted to like play something for them, like Eddie Murphy, for example. Like, I'm not going to carry Party All the Time with me, but I've had Eddie Murphy in there and with Serato, and now I can play it with him there.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Again, everybody with iTunes is like, okay, I'm a DJ now. And the cream will rise to the top no matter what. It doesn't matter. Like, it's not like the market was flooded, but venues that were smart knew that you didn't have to go with the guy that was a quote unquote DJ just because they had the music. The old days, you had to amass enough records to do a night, and you would have spent that time learning how to, like, the technical side of it. So, like,
exactly.
As soon as you were ready to go in front of a crowd, you had, like, some skills. Serato knocked that out.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they just go straight in. And I think that's a good point. Like you said, it's the timing of it. I mean, obviously, DJing's about timing in many ways, but it's like you can't just – you give someone a jack-in-the-box thing and they twirl the handle. If it pops out right away, nothing's happening. It has to be that perfect timing, just like a comedian with a joke or something. If you do it wrong, you're not going to get that conversation with the crowd.
Yeah. I mean, people – so many people talk about DJing and being a stand-up comedian mirroring each other.
Yeah.
That operates on many, many, many levels.
Yeah, I think it's true. I mean, comedians have a bit harder time because they don't just get to play the Drake record if everything falls apart.
Yeah, you know? Right.
They literally just
like
bomb.
Hit the panic button.
Yeah, like they have to just use yeah. their words. So I feel like they have a different level of like trapeze artists. Like they have no net and we have the net.
Right.
But there are similar things of doing a set and being solo and having to, you know, get the energy from the crowd and give the energy to the crowd. And I think, you know, the crazy thing is, like we're saying, we've known each other a while, we've been doing this a while, but we're both consistently still working now.
If you had told me, I have these moments in my life where I'm like, if you had told me 10 years ago I'd still be doing this, I'd say you're crazy. And then exactly. like another 10 years passes. I mean, I work more now than probably I've, you know, as much as I've ever worked.
I know. What I mean? Right. But I feel like now you're able to work a bit smarter.
Yeah, sure.
Than the 7 night a week thing. You don't need to do that, I guess. But yeah, same. I had like, I'm crazy busy and doing different things and things I never thought would happen. You know, oh, I've never done this kind of gig or I've done this kind of thing.
It's funny.
Yeah.
It's like a renaissance over and over again.
I know. I mean, what do you notice? Like, what are some different, you know, it's kind of like the Dazed and Confused, like, I get older and they stay the same age. Like that's the way we are with just the crowd. I'm not just talking about girls, you know, obviously we're not like creeps out here, but. But how does that like apply, you know, like, cause you were doing this, let's say 2006, you know, to these crowds every night. And now you're doing it, you know, to what year is it? It's 18 years later. Yeah.
What you have to pay attention to, the main thing to pay attention to is you have to acknowledge the crowd's point of reference, right? So if you're DJing in the early 2000s, the crowd that's like the predominant crowd in the early 2000s, like their point of reference is going to be whatever. They're still going to know what the Beatles are. They're going to know these songs, right? So if you're doing open format.
And like the 80s is where they were like hearing their parents
exactly.
play music.
So now you just have to be aware of the points of reference. And that's what's going to, DJs who have a vast musical knowledge, they'll be able to navigate that because they can figure out what the point of reference is.
Right.
It's like right now for a young crowd, give them the TRL stuff. I mean, that's what they're going to get hyped on, you know, because that's the point of reference, you know? So that's really all you got to do. If you want to service a crowd that has a wide age range.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right. No, that's exactly, that's such a good way to put it.
But also, like, you know, something current is like, because music's so accessible, whatever your platform is, TikTok or Apple Music, whatever, doesn't always say when this stuff, the music came out. So like a lot of songs are old, but nobody knows that they're old because the algorithm is suggesting this stuff. And also TikTok's been able to like resurrect old songs.
Right.
So it's just weird. Like we spent all last year playing ABBA, and not even ABBA song that I would play when ABBA was the point of reference for the crowd, right? So it's, and same with the—
Right, because it's an extra point of reference that didn't exist. Like it's this TikTok or an app that everybody's like, oh my God. And it's music supervision plays a bigger role because like entertainment is bigger now than just like a TV show. So now it's like, okay, Kate Bush is huge because Stranger Things.
Wild.
Murder on the Dance Floor, you know.
I never played either of those songs prior to last year.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And now like everyone's singing it from a 8-10-year-old, like, you know, my son, to like anybody, you know, a 40-year-old.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So that
but
is
not a bad thing. You know what I mean?
It's cool. I mean, I do think it, cause even like I'll do this Party Electric Feels and it's 18 and over and they're singing every word to like a Stroke song and all these songs that came out before they were born. Like how the hell do they know this? But I think they share these playlists too,
right,
on Spotify and on different streaming services. And yeah, it's just, it's all mixed together in a different way.
Imagine growing up where you can listen to any song you want,
right,
whenever you want, as many times as you want.
Yeah.
That's what you're dealing with. And now you're the DJ. So like even as far as a crowd goes, if you're living like does swipe right or swipe left mean get rid of it? Which is the one you, because
I don't know.
Whatever the bad one is.
I got married before the dating app happened too.
I'm in the same boat. I don't know this stuff. But anyway, my point is that if you are controlling your environment all the time musically, and then you go into a venue where DJ's playing, you might not even be aware of why you don't like what's going on because you're so used to like getting rid of it as soon as you don't like it. Right.
Right.
So it's subconscious almost. And never in my life up until this like current age of like TikTok and stuff, have someone come up and not request a song, but rather request that I change the song that's playing.
That's hilarious. That's happening to me too. I never really thought about it like that. And they just give me a thumbs down. And I'm like, to me, a thumbs down is like a middle finger. Like, right? It's annoying.
Right.
And yeah, I'm like DJing. I see these girls dancing. And then I put on one song within like this sequence of like a whole mix of things that I'm doing. And she freaks out, runs over, just thumbs downing, switch it. And it's
I think it's swipe left. That's the bad one, right? So like they can't swipe left from what you're playing. You're in control and they're in your environment. You know what I mean? So like whether they can even acknowledge what their problem is, they just know something's not sitting right.
Yeah. And they want to control everything. I mean, this happened to me last weekend and somebody came up and they said, oh, can you play this, you know, by a certain artist? And I didn't want to play it. And I was like, no. And then they were like super weirded out that I said no. But it wasn't like, I was just like, you asked me a question, I gave you an answer. Like, I'm not going to play something by that artist. No. And then, you know, it comes back. She goes, you hate me. I'm like, okay, obviously I don't hate you. I don't even know you. I just told you an answer. Then like it turns into this control thing where they want to control what I'm doing. Where at this venue, it's not necessarily appropriate to play this type of genre, music, artist. You know, I know the deal where I am. I know I've had conversations with the owners and the people, and you know what to play or not, obviously. And it's a bigger deal because you have consistent work with this place. It's not just about someone slipping you $100. It's not worth it, you know?
Your client is who hired you.
Exactly. So the guy tries to give me $100. I say no. And he's like so surprised.
Yeah.
And then he pulls me, he goes, come here, man. I'm like, what's up? He goes, and I'm sorry if like this is coming across bad, but, and he goes, so this is bigger than all that. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, her sister, she has cancer and she's dying and we don't know how much longer she's going to be here. And she really wants to hear the song. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. Like, I already told you, now you're just making it weird. Like, this is how much you're trying to control it, you know? And also, then he goes, well, what can you give me then? What can you do for me? And I'm just like, what? I can just go hang out. You're having the greatest night ever. I'm doing a great 3-hour set. Like,
what? You know, the funny thing is, what I think there's some type of a barrier of people acknowledging that if you don't like what's playing, in 60 seconds, something else is going to play.
Exactly. Like, and it was 1:47 a.m. Yeah. I said, you're going to be in your car in 15 minutes, you know? And he's like, they were just getting so upset.
You didn't sit down for a movie, you know what I'm saying? It's a song. And we quick mix, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we don't play stuff for very long. So you're going to survive, man.
Right.
But
and
also,
she asked me to play Ciara 1-2 step or something as the alternative. I'm in some whole different tempo. I'm just being a nice guy, which I shouldn't have. I go make my way all the way there, tempo-wise, smooth mixes,
you're getting it.
Then they give me all the shit of like, can you play the thing? And it's like, leave me alone. I'm just trying to be nice
out
here.
Requests these days, like, it's a gateway drug. So you just got to stop it. You got to nip it in the bud because once, if you take money, and I never take money, because like that's just opening up a can of worms. Like, you're beholden to them, even if it's just for the one song.
Yeah.
And it just, it's like, if you're willing to show, you'll do it once,
right?
You do it twice, you do it three times. And it really costs, it doesn't cost anything to like ask, right? You know what I'm saying? So I'm just always like, let me just do my thing, you know?
It's the control generation. I mean, and we've always had that, even in the vinyl days. It's a human thing, but now it's just different, you know,
vinyl, you were limited to what you had with you.
Right.
Or line.
That's what I told them. They kept begging for Ashley Simpson too after that. And I go, I've never played an Ashley Simpson song in my life. I don't have it in my computer. Leave me alone.
You ain't got no Ashley Simpson in your Serato.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But
does any DJ? I mean, there's a whole other
people don't know that you're playing from your iTunes library. You know, of course, there's technology that's changing that.
Yeah. Well, BeatSource. I mean, you as can an play example, any stuff. I'm not going to let them know that.
Of course not. But yeah, they're like, what do you mean you don't have it?
Yeah.
I don't have the MP3 of it. I'm playing MP3s.
And that's the Spotify control thing.
Right.
And also the other thing that happened same night, this girl comes up, hey, something. I heard you're a great DJ or something. I'm like, oh, wow, that's nice. What do you have coming up? And I go, I don't know. I'm literally just making it up as I go. I go, there was no one in the club 3 minutes ago, and now it's full. That's LA. It's how it works.
Sure.
You know, at 12:14, empty, 12:16, full.
Yep.
And she goes, well, let me see, and puts her head and starts looking at my computer. I go, you're not looking at anything. And she goes, I don't know any of that stuff. And I go, you're looking at a crazy crate. It's not what's coming up next. There is no coming up next. And like, she just could not comprehend, you know.
It's it's hard. You can't not only – can you not really explain what you're doing? You don't have time to be explaining what you're doing. You know what I mean? Like, let me do my job.
Right.
You know? And also, don't go into a sushi restaurant and get mad because there's no pizza. I mean,
thank you.
I mean, I don't even want to vent here. I mean, it's pointless.
No, it's fine. But I mean, I think a lot of DJs deal with that, you know? And it's evolved over time and stayed the same. It's so funny. But.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
It is.
We signed up for this.
Yes, we did.
I have no hate.
Totally. And I deal with things better now than I did before. I think things would throw me off a lot before. I do want to go back in time and delve into your early days. But one thing I just thought of that I think would be an interesting thing to talk about that plays into that was the early days of being a traveling DJ and a traveling bottle service DJ.
Yeah.
And also the early days of Serato and not having that much stuff and not knowing – you did have to kind of get to know the different areas you were going. And I would see DJ AM would always do this thing like, hey, what's big in Chicago right now? What are the big songs? What's in New York? What's in all these places? You know, and in LA, it was different than Miami and anywhere else. And I remember one time I had some, you know, not good times in a lot of cities. There was, because they were also crazier. Like, you would get pulled. Like, I remember being pulled off. Oh, like, I think I got pulled off in LA, Vegas, Miami, New York, Chicago, you know, all these places. And New York, I remember I was DJing, and I think it was maybe at some place, a hot spot at the time. And what I can remember, you were there.
Uh-huh.
And the owner or the manager or whoever it was said, hey, put on house music or something like that. And we didn't play house music at the time. It was like we would play like Lose Control, Missy. You know, that was our 128 BPM.
Yeah, there was just a handful of like electronic records that would get mixed in, but you could
maybe
do, like,
Show Me Love, but you don't play like
Daft Punk records.
It was separated. That was called like Euro stuff, or it was just a different world. Like Tiesto wasn't mixed with the open format. And so I remember the guys asking me to play house, and I played like maybe two songs I had gotten from DJ Riz or something, you know, with like Fat Man Scoop over it, thinking, I'm going to appease him. And then they're screaming at me saying I'm doing the worst job, and you were there, and then you pretended to not know me.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The last time this came up, I think, was the first time I had remembered that. And I mean, you're saying it now, and I'm only aware of it because of the last time this came up, like 10 years ago. Whatever.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't remember exactly what I said. It was in New York, and I do remember it. But yeah, I think I denied. I don't think I said I'm not associated with this guy. I don't think I said I don't know you. I probably said something like I don't know him like that.
Yes, which is probably true. To be honest, we probably only knew each other for a couple years.
I would want
to
help you out and say like. But I mean, I feel like probably in that environment and that situation that you're dealing with, there was no out. You know what I mean?
No.
There was no out.
I mean, yeah, I that was not good. I mean, and that was a time where you just get thrown off by that stuff, either someone in the crowd or the manager yelling at you. Like, now I can deal with it way better.
Yeah.
But that would ruin my whole thing. I didn't know how to come back. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have as big of a music knowledge and library and all that.
I think we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
Like when there was the Red Bull DJ team.
Oh, yes.
And they were sending us to... You know, just for context for anybody listening, so there was a Red Bull DJ team. There was eight of us on the team, and what they were doing is they were building out their infrastructure to have local DJs for local events, right? But at the time they had these eight DJs, and they'd send us to markets that didn't necessarily have like a big nightlife scene,
right?
And they'd add value to those venues by saying, okay, we're going to send in Spider, we're going to send in Graham. Vice was on it. Stone was on it. Jesse Marco.
Yeah.
Tina T.
And it was two different like seasons of it too. Cause then there was another one, like Mick was on it.
Yeah. Mick was on, I think White Shadow joined too. So it was a great experiment, and it was a lot of fun as a concept. But what I'm getting at was, we were going and doing these shows individually. And I was starting to have some shows like, man, these are not great.
Yeah.
But I was like keeping it quiet. But I think one time you and me were like, I'm like, how are your shows going? And you're like, oh, they're bad. I'm like, okay, so I'm not the only one, right? To send me into like a theater in Birmingham, Alabama, and then maybe like 20 people show up because that's not the culture. Like that nightlife culture is not there. It doesn't attract that many people. So it was one of the only times I threw in the towel. I didn't even get pulled, but I got booked at this place in New York that what they play is soca music. And I didn't even know what soca music was.
That's
music
so funny.
Was
similar things happened to me, yeah.
And I'm talking to I walk in and it's 2,000 people in this club. It's going off. And I talk to the residents and I'm like, hey, man, I don't know. Like, I don't want to ruin the night.
Right.
He's like, no.
I'm about to play Herb Alpert.
Yeah, right. And he's like, no, it's all good. You know, we play some pop stuff too. I think like Party Rock Anthem was big at the time. And I was like, all right. And in my head, I'm like, okay, well, I can do like a dance hall throwback set that would kill. And then the guy who was going on right before me tore through the dance hall throwback set. So, I mean, I played for like 30 minutes. I did my best walking that line. And I told the guy, I'm like, yo, I'm pulling myself.
Yeah.
Just for like the sake of the night, you know, like,
right.
That was the right move. But, yeah, you know, it's just one of those things you have to like, you got to navigate. And that's the thing. It's going to be different every time.
Yeah.
And you got to think on your feet. That's part of the job too.
Yes, exactly. And the only way, I mean, the experience is what helps you through all that.
Yeah. Well, that's what going back to what I was saying about learning how to interpret a crowd.
Yeah.
It's those failures too that inform that. You know what I mean?
It is.
Yeah.
Really. So okay, let's go back in time.
You wanted to go back to throw me under the bus about denying knowing you. Like, hey,
I love that story.
This is Festivus. We're going
to
airing of
to
the
me,
grievances.
In my head, it's like I'm probably remembering it wrong, but it was like, it's like a movie scene.
I remember it, but only because you had brought it up before.
I love the bad moments of DJ.
Yeah,
the fact that we're both living our life and successful at it now, and we've made it through all those bad moments shows like it's what I even tell my son in like insane high stress moments, like you're not gonna die. Like, you're going to be alive the next day eating your breakfast burrito still. Like, you're not going to die. Like, it's just stress and it's just a bad feeling, but like, you'll make it through and you'll learn and you'll go forward. So, but at the time I felt like I was going
to
die.
Yeah, of course. I feel like the stakes were probably higher back then, or yeah, they appeared to be higher back then.
Right.
Super competitive.
Yeah.
And
right.
You know, and
there was only a few DJs too now. Yeah. Now there's more, which it's weird. It's more competitive now, but less, but because there's the legacy relationships and the like you said, the knowledge and the experience that only certain people can bring to the table and can only do certain kinds of gigs. I mean, in last month, I did so many different types of gigs that required so much different research and knowledge, and, you know, that only certain people can do it. And that's why even with these private events, like only you and certain people can do that, you know, and be able to ask, do this kind of event, these kind of people. Well, no, so I'm not going back to that, but I'm going way back to way back into time. So you grew up in L.A.
Yeah.
Right? You're sure. L.A. native.
Yes.
I am too. There's not many of us out there.
Correct. And West Side at that.
West Side at that. Yeah. Real deal L.A. And like, I have all these connections to your family that like, yeah, I didn't even know. Like, I went to high school with one of your brothers.
Yeah. And then my brother worked with your sister.
Yes. I mean, and then both of our siblings are like successful
acclaimed chefs.
Yeah, yeah. Chefs and have amazing restaurants, yeah, and they actually work together just randomly without us even part of that.
It's a small world.
Yeah. Such a small world. And then, cause I mean, I'm at school with someone with the last name Funky and I'm like, wait, is that your brother? You know, in 12th grade. But yeah, so we both grew up in LA, which also probably we had similar paths to leading us to being interested in DJing. Like I grew up in L.A. and, of course, loved hip-hop, Tribe Called Quest, Gangstar type stuff, but also Dilated Peoples, you know, all the dope hip-hop stuff. But also I got introduced to raves and Insomniac specifically,
sure,
and going down to downtown L.A. in the early 90s and going to see, you know, Pasquale's Party, which was just like called Insomniac but was just kind of a warehouse that would get broken into with generators and DJs kind of,
yeah,
and if the cops came, everyone would just scatter like roaches and leave. And it was just kind of the beginnings of all of this stuff.
Yeah. There was a moment where, this is such a broad topic.
It is. But that's what, I guess the reason why I'm bringing it up is because that's what taught me really about DJing and mixing things together and seeing like RAW and DJ Trance and, sure, DJ Dan and Oscar Da Grouch and Ron Decor and all these people taking, let's say, happy hardcore that's like 180 BPM and then putting a hip hop acapella over it, or yeah, breaks, or the beginning of jungle and drum and bass, and seeing the mixing of the genres and seeing four turntables set up and these people working together. I had never seen anything like that.
Ironically, my desire to DJ comes from the rave culture too. So
yeah,
back in 1991, I started going out to, we didn't call them raves. Like rave was a verb.
Right.
Totally. Not a
it was
noun.
Just a
now
party.
It's a noun, right?
Yeah.
We call it underground parties.
Right.
The underground. You're going to the underground this weekend.
Yeah.
And I was a kid. And
the underground.
Yeah, you're going to the underground.
Well, there was Insomniac. There was Family.
This predates Insomniac. So okay. Pasquale starts Insomniac in 93. Prior to that,
When I started going.
Yeah, I'd known Pasquale long before that. We went to our first undergrounds together.
Amazing.
And we're still close friends.
And for everyone that doesn't realize, that's not super in the biz, Pasquale
Rotella is a founder and CEO of Insomniac that throws
the
EDC.
Biggest
and, yeah,
worldwide rave, you know, party event company, one of
yeah,
them, you know.
And certainly the most respected, in my opinion. But yeah, going back to 91, when we started going out to those underground parties, in those days, it was two rooms. A room called the Techno Room, which wasn't even like necessarily techno.
Yeah.
It was all manner of electronic music in 1991. So you could hear like Rosala or like Joey Beltran. Like it was anything electronic, which was, you know, in Los Angeles in 1991, there wasn't a whole lot of outlets for that. There was a couple record stores on Melrose. But the side room was the funk room.
Yeah.
And that's where I gravitated to, because that room was playing disco records, funk breaks, and then hip hop of that time, 91. So like, just like the golden age stuff. And those two DJs that played in those rooms
regularly were a guy named Sean Perry, not New York Sean Perry.
Yes.
The OG Sean Perry. In fact, on my phone, there's Sean Perry NYC and OG Sean Perry.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, shout to both of them. We love you, Sean Perry NYC as well.
And Mike Messick was the other ones who was playing in those rooms. And after that era, those guys would go on to be like the Hollywood DJs throughout the 90s. In fact, working for Bold House and them as well, right? Those were the guys. But at that time in 91, they would play these small rooms. For all I know, maybe they're doing a Hollywood club and then doing these after hours underground parties, funk rooms.
Right.
But that's where I fell in love with that style of music. But a friend of mine decided he was going to throw his hat in the ring and throw an event, not Pasquale, somebody else, and hired Mike Messick. I ended up driving Mike Messick to the event.
Okay.
And I carried his crates in.
Oh, okay.
And just the amount of attention and then being able to be in the booth and like see the job, I was like, oh my God, I love this. Now, as a side note, it's exactly how AM started, carrying records for Mike Messick just a few years later.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he used to carry Mike Messick's records. And, you know, because like I said, those were the Hollywood guys.
Yeah.
And I known AM since high school as well. We go way back. He used to come to the underground parties too. He was part of like the, you know, a vast social circle, right?
I had so many friends and people in different schools and everything, and you'd all meet there in the weekend.
Yeah, so that's where I fell in love with DJing, and that's why I started collecting records. And I was collecting records that I was hearing in the funk room. So I was mostly my collection was like disco and like rock breaks, stuff like that. That's how I got into it.
Okay.
But yeah, Pasquale in 93 starts Insomniac, and I played all the Insomniac events through the 90s, you know, the Nocturnals. I would come down. I was living in San Francisco at that time, but I would come down and do the funk room there, just like the olden days, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that was like, that's crazy. So I feel like we had a similar start and, you know, you were in it deeper and were better, closer friends. But I mean, the crazy thing is a lot of the names you're saying right now, you still work with, which is, I mean,
yeah.
Because you're doing work with Pasquale and Insomniac right now.
Right.
Still. And yeah. I mean, I know you still DJ EDC things.
They have a disco at EDC. So,
right.
And, you know, there was a few years where we actually did like a funk stage at EDC, like a proper stage.
Like a whole stage.
Jazzy Jeff played, Z-Trip played. We had some of the Beat Junkies. We had Soul Clap. We had Craze.
Right.
But those festivals are not, they're not built for that kind of
yeah, they're kind of like
performance.
Right.
They do better in a more intimate space, which is why at EDC they have the Good Times Disco in downtown EDC, and it's light up dance floor and they play disco in that room. So I come and do that room, you know, and that's where I thrive, you know what I
right.
mean?
Right. And you also mentioned Brent Bolhouse, which you know, iconic figure and influential figure in the entire Hollywood bottle service scene and the, you know, most high profile, insane parties ever and having AM and you guys and everybody part of it. And you still work with him now at all of his
places. I work with Brent Bolhouse and Jen Rosero. They, I mean, their names still ring out after decades. You know?
They're true legends in the game and have birthed and created so many amazing things, right? I mean, like just books worth of amazing stories and events.
You know, it's I've talked about this before where, you know, I think AM's, how he launched into the stratosphere.
Yeah.
Jen and Brent are like a component of that happening, you know, because their own trajectory, like AM's with them, you know what I mean?
Yes.
You know, a lot, In terms of like the AM story, very few people can map it out like from point A to point Z, right? Mm-hmm. Most people get onto him at like point S,
right?
So there's this whole other like a section of his DJ career that people don't know about, and it has to do with Jen and Brent, but also Body English. You know, that was getting the residency there, and then also
Body English was like the first bottle service club? It was in Hard Rock.
The bottle service story is like a rabbit hole at this point. But yes, one of the first, Body English opening up was like LA planting a flag in Las Vegas in terms of like a club. Right,
like this is the sound from LA. This is the DJ from LA. and we're going to bring it to Vegas in a big, huge way.
Yeah, my experiences in Vegas prior to going there in 04 was there was some hip hop there, obviously, but most of the clubs played like trance. So when you had that that initial moment where a lot of clubs opened, like 04, 05, Body English, 40 Deuce, Pure, yeah. Right? There was Light, Raw. There was Rain. Well, Raw
was before it, right?
Raw was existing when I went out there in 04. And so the quote unquote open format style of DJing, I don't think that wasn't prominent there. That was prominent in LA and New York. And the reason for it, I've heard a lot of people say, make the claim that they invented the open format style or the party rocking style, right?
Yes.
Which no one invented that. It was not invented. It was birth of necessity for the kind of clubs in LA and New York where you had a variety of people that you had to service. You could have Dr. Dre and Slash and George Clooney in the club. So in order to like make everybody happy, you would play a rock song and a hip hop song and an old school, an 80s song, right? You were,
yes.
That's where that comes from. And if you want to peel it back even further, when they started to develop DJing as we know it, if you go back and look at Kool Herc, Afrika Mambaataa, these guys that started DJing, there was no genres for them either. They were playing the records that made the crowd move. And that's why if you go back and look at those break records, it isn't anything specific. They were playing whatever was working for that crowd. Open format, right? So like the very DNA of DJing as we know it is open format. Now, over the years, of course, it breaks off into genres and styles, right? And that's, you know, that's natural. But I'm just saying like the open format, finding the connective tissue between different genres and then making that your set, that is, you know, the very nature of DJing.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it took people like you were saying, AMU and Stone Rock and different people and Vice and to add their own flair and style to the open format, I guess, to...
Yeah, I mean,
I loved it into a different way.
Yeah, I loved all that stuff. I mean, we never called it open format.
Of course.
I don't even know where that comes from.
It was
from.
Just called DJing.
It became mashup suddenly. Oh, yeah, and I was mashup. What's mashup? Like, what is this? And I'm not talking about the songs that were mashup songs, many of which were horrible because people didn't realize that you have to have stuff in key. And, like, songs have, like, different parts and there's key changes, you know?
Right.
But yeah, that became like the buzzword. And, I have some, like old radio spots from when I used to go work in Hawaii a lot and they would be, it'd be like Las Vegas is number one mashup. Bad boy is back, you know, this kind of thing. And
I'd be like, bad boy.
Mashup cowboy or what, you know? No, like I said, you know, it was stuff we liked and we just find a way.
People were just trying to come up with things. Like, remember I had the, when I won the Rockstar energy drink thing and then I had to go DJ in the guy's house and one of the people just said to me, listen, bro, it's one thing we ask of you. You need to crush it in the mix.
Yeah, you used to say that. You used to say that, I remember.
Because some guy said that to me. And I'm like, all I know is I'm going to crush it in the mix.
Yeah, make sure
whatever
you crush
that means.
It in the mix.
It's the most made up term ever.
Yeah.
But yeah, people were just making things up. And the mashup thing, it was
the
same.
Party rock. I mean, there was like a lot of terms applied to what that was. And then even the definition of those terms changed because there was a time when like open format just meant EDM and like, you know, 70 BPM hip hop. And that was
kind of what that
format means
now, I feel
is
like.
Is that right?
I don't know. In Vegas, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, you know, when we play at Bungalow, you know. Jen and Brent's
So spot. So you play at Bungalow, just for people listening, is a collection of
There's multiple venues in different markets, and they've been around quite a long time, which is irregular for a nightlife venue,
right?
But they
seem to have a different approach. Like it used to be in Hollywood, you were around for a little bit of time. It was like a star, you know,
they turn over quick,
and then it would just burn out. But like these are. Have longevity and the crowd comes to party and there's
they
day,
go
there's
there,
night.
The majority of people going there know what they're in for, right?
Yeah.
And what I'm getting at is the programming is like a house party. And at a house party, you would hear a little bit of everything, right? It's what I would call open format.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm getting at. There's so many definitions now. If I said open format to one person, it's going to mean one thing.
Totally.
And to someone else, it means something else. Open format means like multiple formats, right? I guess. Who knows?
It's just too scientific.
I just do what I do.
Yeah, you do what you do. And but it's incredible because you still Bungalow is run by Brent Boldhaus and Jen Rosaro, and like I you know, it's amazing to see what they've done. You're still working with them. You've helped them.
Yeah, I love it.
Build
there.
These up, and you know, I think you're, you know, one of the main driving forces of the sound of those places, well, right?
I mean, I don't know about all that, but
okay, I think so.
I do what I do.
Okay.
But yeah, what they do, which is went out of favor at some point, I don't know why, they have resident DJs, right? DJs that like work this specific night. And so they know what crowd's coming in. They know how to work that crowd. Whereas like we went through a long phase of you're rotating DJs out who haven't been there maybe in 4 months.
And then you're judging them and getting upset about things too.
Yeah. It became a weird culture. So like the resident, that's how things used to be. You might have an opener, but like the resident DJ is a resident DJ. They know how to work their room.
Yeah.
That's their, that's their field. So they have that and, you know, Jen and Brent go so far back, they know what they're doing. They know which DJs to hire that can do the job.
Right.
You know, it's not like they're waiting for someone to be like, please deliver to me like the solution to all my problems. They know all the DJs.
Everybody that's there is a dope DJ.
Yeah, they're seasoned. No, everybody's seasoned.
Yeah, like solidly dope. You know, like knows what's up in any sort of situation and could handle any length of set, you know. And
yeah.
Is a dope DJ. So no, that's amazing. So all right, so let's so you get into the rave stuff.
Yeah, I was not, when you say get into the rave stuff.
Okay, so you're going to the funk room.
Let me tell you what, in 1991 it wasn't like what you associate with rave stuff now.
Right.
Or even in the 90s wasn't necessarily happening in 91. We were still dressing like gangsters. We were all like skateboarders and surfers and doing graffiti and stuff, you know, like, so we were dressed in, you know, Dickies and it wasn't slowly, you know, we start to implement like some of those components. And it's funny, like, you know, on some of the projects I've been working on with Insomniac, which is detailing the history of American rave culture, you know, Pasquale and I for years have maintained that like, oh, we were on that first wave, only to find out by talking to some of the guys from the 80s that were promoting that we were the nail in the coffin. We've had these promoters from the 80s that were like literally developing the components, which would become the rave culture, tell us as soon as the kids showed up dressed like gangsters and cartoon characters, it was over.
Wow.
And all this time we were like, oh yeah, we were, you know, we're OG in that scene. We were an OG in that scene. Like I said, we were like the death knell.
That's funny. Well, I remember even when we started going like 93, 94, it was, everyone was like, oh, these new kids are so annoying and they're ruining everything for the people that were here from 90, 91. I'm like, I don't know. You know, I'm just trying to come in and hang with you guys. But yeah, I think every generation looks at the next one like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah, of course. And we were young to be going out to those parties. So we're, you know, we're like 15, staying out all night doing what have you. And
yes. Definitely, but all night.
But
end up on the beach with the sun coming up and stuff.
Yeah, you know, and you know that culture goes through many, many ups and downs, but I like to say it survives, now thrives, you know.
Yes.
EDC does, you know, sells over 500,000 tickets on over one weekend, brings amazing. In crazy amount of money to the Las Vegas economy every year.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's nuts.
And you mentioned you were working with them over the past year and a half or more on more of like a film side of things, or
yeah, you know, what are you doing with them? I started writing for magazines many years ago, and then
I mean, you're, for people who don't know, you're an incredible writer. Period. Just writing.
I'll take the compliment.
You really are.
I used to write everybody's bios too. If you remember,
yeah.
Almost every DJ's bio was penned by me.
As I mean, rightfully so. And I know you've written things in the entertainment business and scripts and been involved in all types of stuff on that side of things. You've been in commercials, which we should discuss.
I'm a jack of all trades, master of none.
So you've been, you know, in the DJ world, but you also have a solid foot in the entertainment world and different sides.
I just like to pursue stuff that's fun to me, you know?
Right.
It's like Tom Waits. He does a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, I started.
And so what do you do with them in that respect now?
Yeah. So I was, So, you know, going back a little ways here. I started writing for some magazines, got interested in writing for film, did some projects, got into the Writers Guild. So a producer came to me.
Are you still in the Writers Guild? You get insurance?
this is a long topic.
Okay, that's fine. Skip.
I'm just thinking
how DJs don't have health insurance.
So. Oh, well, yeah, you know. I think
we need our guild. It's happening, guys.
I don't know if that's going to happen or not. Maybe.
Don't. Yeah.
You know, there's two. It's. God, I don't even know. Do DJ people want to even hear about this stuff? I don't think so.
I don't know.
But anyways. So I started working on something with a producer, and then who also had a relationship with Insomniac.
Okay.
And so we went to talk to them about this, and then just based on that, you know, they had these other projects that kind of needed some. Not oversight's the wrong word because they know what they're doing over there. But I had expertise on both sides of that. You know, I know that the culture, and then I know narrative storytelling, right?
Yeah.
So I started working on a bunch of projects that they had in the works, a museum show, and some film projects and some TV projects. So I do a bunch of different tasks for them over there in that area. Not their core business. Core business, obviously. Massive events.
Yeah.
This is some ancillary stuff that's all culture driven. You know, it's right. Really, really, really cool stuff. And I think it would benefit everybody, be really interesting when they all land.
I think so too. I mean, it's like the bigger it's gotten. I mean, I remember being at Sundance, the Insomniac movie, I think.
Oh, I was there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a documentary from some years ago. I don't remember. It was like opening night. They opened up the film festival and they had the party.
That was like a big deal. Maybe and it's Zed only going to get bigger. Yeah, I think so. And I mean, with all types of things. I mean, there's a hip hop museum now. I mean, there's going to have to be rave museum.
Well, you know, what I've discovered in working over the last 18 months is so little of it was documented. It was like super underground. And so there's not a ton of like archival footage or photographs. There's ephemera. Like
people don't want to see pictures of themselves with big pupil eyes.
Or do they? That's the thing, you know?
No, there just wasn't very much. I don't have very much recorded. You know, I'll find these blogs sometimes where they'll take the cassette. I still have some cassette tapes, you know, but
from the rave.
Yeah,
we'll have to talk after this.
Oh, I have a bunch. And then also I found these blogs that'll post them up, and I'm like, I remember listening to this like in my friend's car, being like 15 years old, you know, sitting in the Palisades like listening to this live mix from a rave or something. And
you know, it's like it was a subversive culture, right?
Yeah.
It was misunderstood, and there's been many, many points where society has tried to stop it, including Joe Biden in 2002 with the Rave Act, right? Like there's been
drugs and the association.
It's just misunderstood. Yeah. It's like there's drugs at any concert you go to.
Of course, but it's different. It's looked at differently.
Yeah, it's a headline. This rebellious activity goes on to become not just accepted but respected, right? And it informs a good portion of popular culture at this point. And that's happened with many, many, many subcultures. You know? You can't stop this kind of thing.
Right. It's true. You can't. I mean, you see it with hip hop. You see it with the rave culture. And I think when the ticketing industries start to realize, oh, my God, they're making money. Okay, let's act like we like
it. It's funny you say that because in 91, I don't know. But the organic nature of the rave scene when we were going out in 91 was you'd go to a ticket spot. You buy that ticket, and that map might take you to a different map spot.
Yeah.
It was like a whole adventure to get to the event. And there was no internet. There was no like
– no, you had to have apps. A phone number to call. The phone number would have a voicemail.
To get to where we're going. And
you take a paper map to like find a store on Melrose.
Yeah.
Pay $20, get that ticket, head to the next place. They would tell you where to go.
But that was part of the adventure. That was what was fun about it.
It was fun.
And at some point, when 808 State was going to perform, if anybody knows, you know, remembers this group.
I do,
Ticketmaster was selling the ticket. Like they had employed Ticketmaster to handle the ticketing. And we were like, oh, well, it's over. Scene's over, right? Because Ticketmaster was getting involved.
Yeah.
And we have a bunch of different points.
That was when they were starting to have it in San Bernardino and a bigger
thing, I mean, that came in the mid-90s when they, like, National Orange Show and, like, venues like that. which I mean, they still do events at National Orange Show. It's like a legacy venue, you know?
Oh God, the amount of crazy things I saw there as a teenager.
Yeah, you know, but it's people that went through that, I think, like, they make it more interesting, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
But but that was like the one, and then when they had the rave at like Knott's Berry Farm, and there's been a bunch of things in that culture where you're like, okay, it's over now. But right. It's just not. It's like it's still going, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, you know?
It is funny, though, that you're right. It's not. It's one of the least scenes of all the scenes that has history. Like that the people now in it know. Like the hip-hop people and different people know a lot more about the early times than I think the people that go to raves now. And they just see it as like what it is, and
it's a spectacle now. It's an experience. It's that. That's why it's like it moved from being a rave to being a festival, right?
And
that's for a lot of reasons. But the experiential nature of like going to EDC, I'll put that up against anything. That thing will blow your mind. Like I don't even know how to describe it.
Right.
You know
no,
what
no,
I mean?
No, it's, I know.
The it's, stages, the stage production is crazy.
It's next level. Yeah. And it's only gotten crazier every year. So you do all that.
Yeah,
you
get into the Hollywood.
You do all that. Well, we could talk for 10 hours. Yeah. So trying to fast forward it to your DJ in LA. I'm sure you're doing all different types of things coming up. You eventually get into the 40 Deuce and Hollywood scene.
Yeah, early 2000s.
You link up with Stone. How long have you known Stone Rock?
I think we met, I probably met him just before starting Vegas in 2004.
Okay. So you guys kind of connect. You've always had your connection.
Well, here's the weird thing. AM brought him in initially, right? Like working under, not when I say working under AM, I don't mean working under AM. He was like, and there's no apprenticeship either. I'm just saying.
Of course, I know what you mean, but he was associated
with
the crew.
AM was bringing Stone along, right?
Yeah, and AM was blowing up and was able to put other people on.
But I never met Stone through AM. I met Stone outside of AM. In fact, like when I met Stone and he had said like, oh yeah, you know, I work with AM, I know AM. I'm like, how come I don't know him? Because I've known AM a long time, you know?
Right.
And at that point in LA, there wasn't a lot of DJs either. There was just a handful of DJs doing all the gigs.
Right.
So it wasn't like he could get lost in the shuffle. So it was always, that was always a mystery, like how our paths didn't cross prior to that.
Yeah.
But once we met, like we just clicked, you know?
Right. And you guys have kind of always had a connection with Captains of Industry and you always do things separately and are very strong separately, but as well as when you're together.
We like to have a good time.
Have a lot of amazing projects you've done,
Captive Industry was birthed out of Abe Froman Showman, which is
a legendary Vegas crew of what? DJ 5, so
DJ
you guys,
5,
Cobra.
Obi-Wan, Kobe, Cobra, Vice,
yes.
Me and Stone. There were six of us.
Oh man, that was
and
OG.
Obviously there had been DJ crews prior to that. There's the Executioners and the Scratch Pickles and the Beat Junkies, but this was
different.
This was not driven by technical skills or, you know, scratch performance. This was people working in nightclubs that we decided to brand collectively. And we started to like take that element and sell it to other markets, you know? And so I hadn't seen that before. Now you see it all the time. You see so-and-so roster takeover, but we were doing that in 2004 and 2005. I hadn't seen it prior to that. But it was bound to self-destruct for a variety
it did
of reasons.
But the captains were birthed out of it.
In the wake of it, me
and
Stone
then,
kept
like
going,
so many amazing things happened. I mean, you guys have so like an infinite amount of creative ideas.
There's no reason not to like implement elements of your own life. Every photo doesn't have to be a dude with a headphone or holding a record or like buttoning his cufflinks.
I mean, you guys
have
like a calendar that's like the most legendary, insane, amazing artwork that you could ever see. If you guys can ever look up the Captains of Industry calendar. But the cool thing to also touch on with that is that you had a brand help you pay for that. A brand said, we're going to give you a bunch of money. What are you going to do with it? And you did that, which was fucking hilarious.
It comes from Red Bull.
Right.
Right. Red Bull at that time, to use an example for what we were going for.
Yeah.
Rashawn White had said something to the effect of, and I'm paraphrasing here, right, or maybe this is third hand information, I don't know. He said, I would like to develop a trick that no one has seen before so yeah, I can premiere it at the next, you know, contest.
Right.
But everybody's checking for Sean White. So he never gets a moment where he can practice a new trick because people have seen it already, right? He's Sean White. So right, I think they built him a half pipe in the middle of nowhere, like a snow half pipe in the middle of nowhere, where he could practice this trick, and then he premieres it at the event. So like right, they were very much in favor of like, how do we fund creativity?
Yeah, totally.
So like the Rebel DJ team, everybody got budget.
Right.
And, you know, people use their budgets for like, I want to get in the studio.
Yeah, I built a website. Yeah, they gave us money towards
Stone things. And I were like, we want brass belt buckles and we want a calendar that's full of artwork that is derivative of like James Bond and blaxploitation movies.
And like everything you guys like in the American Revolution wearing like Speedos or I don't even know. There's like incredible
There's
pictures.
12 amazing illustrations that, you know, that we had to go through the real process of like doing reference photo shoots to give to the illustrator.
Right.
And then we came up with the concepts. The concepts for each month, they mirror a date of that month, but not the obvious date. So not like Halloween.
Yeah.
Right. We chose like tax day. Right. And then the artwork is reflective of that. Or National Aviation Day, which that illustration depicts like a horrendous like air water disaster with life rafts and whatnot.
Incredible. So
that's what we wanted to do. People to this day are like, are you guys going to do another calendar? And I'm like, if you knew how much effort and money goes into these things. But the thinking behind it when we did it is not just that like for our own vanity, we wanted to do this project. It was, here's a promo item that we sent to literally every booker.
That's
or
what I was
going to
touch on is that.
And it hangs in their office all year. And exactly, they're like, what's the next month's illustration? So like the captains are on people's minds.
It's genius. It's like a thing people call like top of mind. Like you want to be top of mind for the bookers. You send this thing where you're going to always be top of mind. You're there. They can't stop talking about it, seeing it. They have it every day. So it's a genius way to remain in the, you know, memory and thoughts of the people booking the clubs as well as doing something hilarious and unique.
If you remember, we did like a chapstick called the capstick, a stick for your lips.
Yes.
Prior to anybody doing that, we did airplane peanuts, nuts for your mouth, if you remember these. We just like had endless ideas. We still have, there's so many shelved ideas that we'd love to do someday.
I'm sure.
But even doing the new eras, like the fitteds, at that time it was almost impossible to get a new era account right, and get fitteds. And we finally got it. We'd wanted it for years. And with Red Bull, they even denied Red Bull. Now I think about it. They told Red Bull no. And we just pushed it through and we finally got, you know, those captains of industry new era hats that people, we have a few on ice, but that's just like, you know, this dope item from the old days.
Throwback. Like a souvenir type thing. And then you also did other things. I know like you have an unreleased song with Lil Jon.
Oh, yeah.
Called Yachts.
Yeah, we did the hit single Yachts. Yeah, this is an unreleased track. It's a in the vein of Weird Al Yankovic.
So Shots.
It's Shots, but it's a jazz, up-tempo jazz version with a jazz band. And Stone and I sing the main parts, but Lil Jon does the interlude like he does on Shots where he lists all the shots. On this song, he lists tropical drinks.
And it's him like, doing it for this song, not like taken from Shots.
We went into his house and recorded Yachts, and he's saying stuff like Blue Hawaiian, Lava Flow, you know, Mai Tais.
Does this ever get played out?
No, you know what? Stone is known to on occasion, when it is relevant,
yes,
play the version of Yachts that exists, but it's never been released. The only way for it to like catch on would be for it to a viral video, which at that particular time when we recorded it was, couldn't happen for a variety of reasons.
Okay.
So no one, very few people have heard it, but
Eric Deluxe is part of it too.
Eric Deluxe also sings, the section that's like Shots, but he says, ahoy, it's the captain's.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That's so good.
I like it, but yeah, maybe one day it comes out. Who knows?
Right.
You know?
Something else we discussed that we were surprised some people didn't know about was that you guys were on Cash Cab.
This is correct. We won Cash Cab. Not so, just on, but we won.
If you guys don't know what Cash Cab is, look it up because it's a hilarious show. I feel like it came back. And I mean, it should be around now. It was one of my favorite shows. But what the hell? So how did that come about? And what happened after the cab?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not going to spill the beans about how Cash Cab gets their contestants into the Cash Cab.
So you're not just hailing a cab.
So I think there's some other things at work, but yeah, when you get into the cab, it's a surprise that you're in the Cash Cab.
Okay.
We were, this is a Vegas episode. I think they did a couple of, Vegas entities like, Carrot Top, Cheech and Chong for whatever reason, or Penn and Teller, something like this. Okay. I don't remember exactly.
Okay.
But, the point of the show was, you know, it's very aspirational. People get in the Cash Cab. They're surprised to be in the Cash Cab. They're excited to be in the Cash Cab. They're collectively answering these questions and winning money and then celebrating when they get the answers right or, you know, getting super bummed when they get it wrong.
It's a game show in a cab but with
then
the
you
driver
put
asking.
Stone and Graham inside the Cash Cab who are like, can be so aloof and condescending.
Right.
And getting the answers right and not celebrating at all.
Right. So for the producers of the show, well, maybe don't love that. Is that what you're saying?
After we had shot the segment, mm-hmm. they were like, that was amazing. But let me peel it back. There was a couple things that were probably like not what the typical Cash Cab show episode was or segment, right?
Yeah.
So on one of the questions, you can phone a friend. That was like their one lifeline, right? I didn't know the answer to something, and I'm paraphrasing here. What marsupial is depicted in South American paintings of the Last Supper?
Okay.
Okay. Well, my dad's a real smart dude.
Yes.
And so I say to, while they're shooting, I go, I shall call my pater familias. And they don't know what this is. It just means Latin for I'm going to call my dad, right? which I call him, and he answers the question correctly. And then we get to the bonus question where you can risk everything. And you win double the money, which, of course, we risked it because I was on my way to go DJ at the Palms. So I was going to make more money than I was going to win on Cash Cab for the DJ set.
Exactly.
Right? So, and we're in Vegas. You got to gamble.
Yeah.
So we get that right, too. So they hand us $1,800. They peel off the $1,800 that we're winning. And usually when people get the money, they're like, oh, my God, I have this money. Stone pulls out like a knot of cash. It's like could choke a horse and just wraps it on the outside of it and puts it back in his pocket like as if it was like valet money.
Oh, God.
So they loved – the producers had loved all how it was like different from normal episodes. It didn't air though.
Because and maybe they want the kind of like a Walmart kind of crowd.
It's
like
very aspirational. Like to how do you root for these guys?
Exactly, yeah.
So we were bummed.
And it was that could be a viral clip. It was just like this on a TV show. Like maybe now it would be amazing because they'd be like, put that one on TikTok.
Well, I mean, not long ago, because we took a photo with Ben Bailey, the host, right after we won the game.
Okay.
And I was put on Instagram and hoping that he would see it and maybe like, can we release the tapes? Now it's been
– right.
It's been plenty of years, right? Yeah. Like, can we see the episode? Because we've never seen the episode.
Oh, my God.
But Ben, we hit it off with him. He came out to we were DJing.
He came out to party with you that
night. Yeah, we worked at Moon at the Palms at the time. And he came out. He's hanging in the booth with us. And, you know, we took it when Moon closed, we took it downstairs to the bar in the casino, you know?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's fun.
That's hilarious. So he couldn't drive after that, obviously.
Yeah, no Cash Cab.
Cash Cab crashed into the Vegas sign. Yep. Yo, that's incredible. What about I mean, it's funny. It's like I feel like there's 7 million topics I want to talk to you about.
It's crazy, yeah.
But, you know,
you got to keep it condensed.
Right.
There's inside baseball.
Right. You know, what about, is there any other kind of stories you want to tell about the evolution of like Vegas clubs. I think that is interesting too, in the sense of where you did start in the beginning of it with the 40 Deuce, right?
Yeah.
And then I remember coming to see you guys, like you said, at the Palms, like at Moon and Playboy Club.
Yeah, it was fun.
And so many places.
Yeah, I opened Tao Beach. First 2 years. I opened Marquee, did Sundays the first year at Marquee. I mean,
that's nuts.
In addition to working all the other spots over those years, like, you know, doing.
And it was
rehab.
Every night, weeknights.
Yeah, I worked
Tuesday
seven
nights.
So not only, there was a stretch where I worked not just 7 nights a week, but then the 2 days a week at Tao Beach. You know, I clocked so many. Flight days and work days in some years that, you know, I don't know if you're a million. Do you fly American? I'm a million miler, which is like.
So I'm at 997,000.
Yeah, so you're close.
I'm about to hit the million. And I also messed it up because I got 600,000 on United.
Yeah, see, I did
this stupid mess up. Plus, if you don't count the Southwest, I mean, right. I got like thousands. I mean, I had Companion Pass. I've had A-List for like 15 years. Yeah. Like. I'm sure I have millions, you know, but yes, I'm about to hit the American million.
When I have my like million miler tags, and all you get is like your
gold
status
for life, right?
But when I see those tags now, it just bums me out.
Right.
It just reminds me of what that grind was for all those years of travel. And like you get used to it, you get acclimated to it, right? And I'm by no way complaining about those years of just being on the road, but there's a lot of sacrifice there for normal life.
I mean, I still do it now. Yeah. I mean,
I cut after COVID, you know, I was still doing it up to COVID. After being at home for that stretch, I was like, wow, I've really missed out on a lot of just life.
It's hard.
I like working locally. I like doing the private stuff. I like working at Bungalow. I mean, I still go to a couple nightclubs here and there, but it's not like the old days where like the chase, you know, and I like it. I like to have normal sleeping hours when I want. There was just a time where like, what happened? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
What happened? But you know, the flip side of that, of working that much, you go into a venue, no matter where it was, and you're just on because like, you're just up and running because you've been doing it every day straight.
You're just in the zone.
And I'm not phoning it in is the wrong word because it's not phoning it in, but I'm just saying like your chops are so sharp that you just go in and kill it every single time. And that keeps you working. You know?
Yeah. That's so true.
Yeah. It's not like that anymore. I mean, I feel like
it is different.
There's less opportunity. I don't think anybody could work 7 nights a week and 2 days a week. I don't think that opportunity exists now.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I don't think there's enough venues.
Especially in a major city.
Yeah. I don't think there's enough appetite. But there was a stretch when it was like that. Those were the crazy days, you know?
Yeah. What do you have any standout? I mean, I know you have a million.
People always ask this question. You know what?
Like insane other besides the, you know, cash app, like crazy Vegas night stories, whether it's from the Body English or from there.
And that's the funny thing. When people say like,
there's
tell us about a crazy story in Vegas. And there's so many and I can't come up with one.
I understand. Same. Like I've had so many and they're all blurred together and I can't.
And it's not
like,
just that. What's the word that I want? You get numb to something that might excite somebody else.
Yeah.
So you're not even registered. Something that's amazing doesn't even register as like something that's amazing or extraordinary. You're just kind of like, okay, yeah, that's a, you know.
Yes.
So it's always hard to come up with those crazy stories, but yeah, there's plenty of them. You can only imagine, especially during those days of Las Vegas where the clubs were like just – exploding, right? The nightlife was going from a town that was like where Wayne Newton's advertised to just being like driven by nightlife, right?
Right.
So we rode that wave.
Yeah.
You know, but the funny thing is, you know, if you want to talk about the EDM bubble, I'm sure you didn't either. We didn't see that coming. You know, we were started to play a few of those songs, but we didn't know those guys were going to come take our jobs, which is exactly what happened.
Probably would have focused a little more on the production aspect. So
if a club has X amount of budget and prior to like the EDM bubble, they're chopping that up over 52 weeks amongst X amount of DJs. But then a guy comes in who needs 100,000 a night and that's like a low number, and that's the budget hasn't increased.
Right.
Now those 52 weeks, it's less money for the open format guys or whatever. So we didn't see that. I mean, I started to work certain songs into the mix when it was coming in, but I didn't know those guys were going to come and take the gigs, right?
Totally. No, I remember. I mean, I remember being at Trist at the Win and being like, oh, I'm the open format guy, whatever it is. And then, slowly but surely, have you heard of Calvin Harris or Avicii or Afrojack? Like, these guys want $25,000 to come DJ here. That's preposterous, you know?
No, that's a low end.
Fast forward to, like, people getting paid, like, $450,000 to DJ 90 minutes at a pool, take a nap, and then go get paid another $450 to DJ at night.
But in terms of a business model, obviously that was working for those venues. Like, you can't hate on them because, like, it's obviously making sense.
Yeah,
whatever it is, if it's increased revenue for the casino or increased revenue for the nightclub, I don't actually know those numbers, but obviously there was a reason why it was happening. And
for sure. And it's still working out for them in certain ways. I think they've adjusted and figured it out. But
there was a stretch where like they had to have a ringer like you or me.
Yeah.
Five on deck.
Right.
For when it wasn't working.
Right.
The EDM superstar wasn't working in the fashion that they needed it to.
Yeah.
Or they had to, you know, stroke certain clients that didn't want to hear that stuff, right?
Yeah, that's true.
The ringers. The grinders, and ringers, you know?
What about you know, you make a lot of edits, which I play and a lot of DJs play, and they're dope. Sometimes I wish they were longer, but thank you for doing it either way.
I think most of those ones that I make, they have to be short because most of them are obscure.
Yeah.
And in order to keep your audience wrapped, wrapped, they can't meander for longer than, you know, 90 seconds, 2 minutes, something like that. That's why I do it. But I take a lot of those songs are songs that I had on vinyl that I wish I could get to this part to mix out without that's waiting true. 2 minutes. Right. So, you know, that was another thing with Serato and Ableton. You were able to take some songs that on vinyl days, you had to like sit through the song to get to the part that was dope to mix out of.
Yeah.
And now I just condense it and
just straight
get
to the
there.
Point.
Right.
What about
a lot of people hated that when we started quick mixing.
Yeah.
Cause,
me too is the number one complaint. Like, why do you quick mix so much?
Yeah. I'm just
like,
getting
now
into
that's
it.
Just the way it
know?
Is.
They would, I'm just getting into the song and then you change it.
Right.
Yeah, well, because, you know, you're trying to maintain
that 3 minute lull,
an energy level, right? There's always like a, when a new song comes on, there's like an excitement that happens, but that wanes, right? So in order to like keep the energy of the crowd, you got to like hit them again soon after.
Yeah.
And that's where that comes, the quick mix comes from, you know?
What do you think makes a good DJ set or a dope DJ, like when you're listening to someone or if you have to, a new person gets brought into a venue you play a lot, like
that's subjective, right? That's because the crowd's opinion of you is subjective, and then your approach to the DJ, a DJ set, is subjective. There is no right answer for this stuff, right?
For sure.
So I don't have an answer for you for that.
Okay.
Because it changes every night. That's what's fun about DJing is it's different. You don't know what curveball is coming or if any curveballs are coming. That's a curveball in itself, right?
Right. And do you like, I mean, I know I do, but like, do you like, people ask me, like, what's your favorite venue or favorite kind of thing to do? And I'm like, I love DJing and I love the challenges. Like, do you prefer doing a movie premiere versus doing a bungalow night versus doing event for
all
a rich
of them,
person? Or,
all
know?
Of them are... all of them are different and like satisfy me in a different way.
Right.
You know, I love
me
doing
too.
Like event stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like those are always a lot of fun because you can take a lot of chances as long as you're keeping the vibe of the event and that's it. And, you know, I think I'm pretty safe bet, you know, doing those things because I can literally play anything.
Yeah.
Or I'm capable of playing anything.
I agree.
And I'm a no-brainer. They don't have to worry, but put me behind the turntables and they don't have to worry about me.
Right.
And if for some reason they do, they just come and tell me something's jacked up and I can, on a dime, fix.
Exactly.
You know? So I love that stuff.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of an experienced DJ that also really cares about stuff and doesn't fall into the sort of hole of like, I don't like new shit or, you know, tries to like be an old, like, love to not know about new things. You know what I mean? I think that's the downfall of a lot of DJs too.
Sure.
Like just have fun with it no matter what is going on.
Yeah, you know, the there's going to be bad songs, or what you consider bad songs, yeah, or how, in every decade,
yeah,
and for every generation. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like I brought up, we talked about the ABBA song earlier.
Yeah.
That was not a song I played back in the day. I didn't like that. I don't even like ABBA.
No.
You know what I mean?
Of course not.
Now you got yourself playing it every single night.
Every night.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. The song's coming to, I mean, even what, Don't Stop Believing, remember?
Yeah, well, it's so funny because we were just talking about that. I'm pretty sure that I was the first person to like put that out there. I have a mixtape from like 2001. And I remember playing it like the Ledoux, but the original Ledoux, the exclusive Ledoux, not right, the Ledoux that came later that's like on the hills, but like the exclusive Ledoux. And people were going like, what are you doing? Like, why are you playing this? And I was like, I don't know. Put it in the mix on vinyl, you know?
Yeah.
I'd put on a mixtape way back in the day. Spinbad might have done it. I don't know. But it wasn't as
popular. But it was not something everyone was playing.
As popular as it became,
yeah,
it was not happening when I had made that mixtape. I mixed it over the bridge of Miss You, you know? So I got roads playing, and I got the pianos playing over it. And then trying to like ride the vinyl because, you know, those.
Right.
No one's playing.
But
no,
you were early on the edits. Like I remember when we, in the beginning of us meeting, you were like, let's do this rock mixtape together.
Oh yeah.
We made a mixtape called Rocket Science.
Don't Stop Believing on Rocket Science?
I think so. I don't know. I have to look.
We were on Serato by then.
Yeah.
We didn't have Ableton though. So like it's a live mix.
No, we did a live mix and you had made edits. Like you had like U2 over Daft Punk and like things like that.
I don't know if I didn't make that one, but that existed.
That was just a mashup, but you had it in the mix. But I mean, I learned so much from doing that mix with you. And then we got so much like acclaim. It was like the MySpace days. Everybody loved it. To this day, people still tell me about it.
It was prior to anybody making a 60 minutes rock.
Yeah. I think we started off with Buck Cherry.
Well, that was it's funny you say that because that would not be something I'd put on.
I know.
But I believe the client requested it to the CD to start because that was made for a client who shall remain nameless.
Yes, I forgot. Oh, you're right. That was the beginnings of why we did it.
Yeah, it's a longer story, but yeah, it was a project that we were doing. We didn't decide to make the rock mix. It was like we were hired to do it.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that the client welched on. They didn't like it. So we put it out ourselves, which is what happened.
Yes. And we got my friend Derek, Urban Medium, to do the artwork. He's here actually in town. I'm going to meet him for dinner at 7 o'clock tonight. Funny enough. But you know, look, I think that's a testament, not to, you know, kiss our own asses, but like if you're just a good human that loves what you do and does it the right way with integrity and pride and try to do the right thing, you can have a long career. Like these are people we've known and worked with now for 15 to 20 years and we're still working with, you know, in a lot of our relationships. And I think that's something that a lot of DJs, you know, write into this podcast and ask me questions. And I think that's just a very basic thing that feels like common sense, but just be yourself, be a normal, you know, not normal, but like be yourself and be a good human and then do everything for the right reasons and do stuff you love and then keep rediscovering it and you can have a long-term career. There you go.
It's just that easy.
No, but I think that plays into it. You know what I mean? Because you see a lot of people like burning bridges and not working with people or not being around and why, you know, or too fucked up or there's so many reasons.
Hey, there's many people falling by the wayside.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever reason.
And like you said, the cream rise to the top and then, you know, you got to doggy paddle up there.
Yeah, right? How to keep my spot.
Yeah.
No, you know, I feel like there was a time where you had to question people's motivation to be a quote unquote DJ.
Yeah.
Right? I don't come from that. I come from starting to collect records because I loved it.
Right.
And then playing a lot for zero money or a little bit of money.
Yes.
And then there being a turning point where like, oh, I can make money doing this. Right. So there was a time where like there was a lot of focus on DJs and people decided that they were like, well, that's an easy way to get attention or girls.
Yep.
Right.
Or just they're addicted to the attention and they realize, oh, that's the way to get it real fast. Yeah. And the control.
Yeah, and they go and they don't last. That doesn't last.
Right.
It's an annoyance, if anything.
And I mean, you know, just to touch on AM a little bit more, because you had such, you have such deep knowledge of him. Like you said, you really can map out from beginning to end for him in a way. Are there any other aspects of his career that, you know, you want to talk about, or stories that people might not know?
I'm sure people
that you can think of.
There are people who are interested in that story a lot because he was so influential to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And a lot of people started DJing because they saw him, and that opportunity came from him being a known entity.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, I knew him before he was DJing and before I was DJing. And, I'd moved back to LA, in 99 from San Francisco, and bumped into him at Nocturnal Wonderland where I was DJing. And
I was probably there.
And he said that he had started DJing, you know, and I was like, oh, dope, you know. And just prior to that, when I moved back, and I hadn't seen him in years, but he was DJing, just to get some context for even AM's career. I'd gone to a restaurant on Melrose, an Italian place, and he was DJing during dinner, right? So like even he has, everybody has those humble beginnings, you know.
Right.
And I didn't even go say what up to him that particular night because I hadn't seen him in so long. And I was like, God, we haven't it's been such a long time. I wonder what it would be like. I didn't want to bother with it, but I,
of course,
like a week later saw him at Nocturnal and he was just like so excited and like so hyped on life. And so like, you know, we reconnected. We weren't close friends in high school. We were just friends because of the social circle, right? We're friendly because of the social
circle.
What
high school?
I think he went to Beverly. I went to Loyola.
Okay.
But the way LA works, as you know, is, you know, you get people from different pockets and they'll congregate in certain areas. So there was close friends of mine who are close friends of his close friends. So we'd find ourselves in situations where we would be around. So there's some photos of us from, you know, 1990 in people's backyards or whatever.
Incredible.
We call him AMG back then, Adam Michael Goldstein, right?
Yeah.
I don't know when he dropped the G. It just became AM. But bumped into him in Nocturnal. And then we just, like I said, back then, 99, 2000, so few DJs in Los Angeles. And we all really had each other's backs. We're like, if you couldn't do a gig, you throw it to the next guy. So
yeah.
And then, you know, some great times I had with him was literally just going to his house with like a bag of like rare records, rare breaks. And we'd go one for one, like trying to one up each other, playing like, oh, you got this, you got this, you got this. So like it all comes from love of the culture, you know what I'm saying? And nothing more than that. He like launched in the stratosphere, which was dope. And
yeah, like what was it like seeing someone that wasn't even a DJ when you met him? And then have that trajectory, like, what was, you know, was there a point where you just went, you're like, holy shit, what happened?
Man, it's not something you're paying attention to at the time.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? The difference between his trajectory and other people who have walked on similar ground is when he got behind the turntables, he killed it. So there's been plenty of people who've had that same kind of opportunity to like, to springboard into something bigger. They're not AM. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's been plenty of people who knock up famous people or have famous girlfriends or like get thrust into the public eye. The difference between all of them and then AM was like AM was just dynamic DJ and took dope risks. You know, if you go watch him at Body English in the old days, you know, throwing like Motley Crue Shout at the Devil, like just like rolling the dice on stuff, but knowing how to get out of it, it doesn't work, you know, keep it interesting. And that's really, I think, what defined him. Also, he's a really nice guy. He made a lot of people feel like you were. I think when he passed away, that was the reason why so many people were affected by it. Was because he really made you feel like you were a friend to a lot of people.
True.
So it sucks that he had passed away. And you know the whole conversation that people say, if AM was still alive, it would not have. DJ would not have turned out this way, and that's bullshit.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
He was powerful, but
he's DJ to the core. He would stick to it, but he was evolving with everybody else. I mean, Banana Split's an example of that, you know what I mean? Where he was like, took that and pivoted to this other thing.
Right.
So
but yeah, he definitely has continues to reverberate through the culture, even when people don't realize it. Because even like, I'm going to go DJ Electric Feels this weekend, you know, and that would be something he would kill. And like Mike B is one of the main people of that, and from Banana Split. And it's these kids that weren't even alive when he was alive, but they want to hear the music. Yeah. And so
I'm just saying that he was evolving like the rest of us.
Yes.
That are dedicated to this evolve.
Right. Right.
So like the idea that it would still be like,
yeah,
you know, like some bedroom scratch off with AM. If he was still alive, it's not that he would.
Right.
He probably would have gone into production or something like that. He would have maybe gone, you know, bigger, but also having those skills that aren't intrinsic of most big artists that are quote unquote DJs. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes. And he. Yeah, I that's a great way to put it. So what about some other things that you're working on? You're at Bungalow. People can see you there.
Weekly. Yeah, every week.
Every week. People can come here.
Yeah.
Your amazing sets.
Yeah, well, you know.
You're working with Insomniac.
Yeah, having some fun.
I'm sure you got
going down the
20
rabbit
other
hole.
Projects you're doing, writing things. And, we didn't even discuss you making money other ways, which was being in commercials.
I was early in my... Yeah, I'm a thespian.
You're in a Starburst commercial and a Citibank commercial, and the Citibank one ran for like 4 years, and you played a song on a
ukulele. I mean, those are just
more of like being in the entertainment industry.
No, it's just like doing stuff I like.
Yeah.
That's really all it was. So like doing some acting stuff was just, it came very natural for me to be in front of a camera. And I had a long stretch. I remember somebody who shall remain nameless, a booking agent, that when my name would come up, he'd just say like, oh, that's just that actor kid.
Oh, God.
Like, no, a disc jockey first. In fact, I remember like most of those commercials, which, you know, call time 6 a.m. I would work the night before anyway. I'd get off at 2 a.m. DJing up. And then, you know, roll out of the car and go do what I do on set. You know, I enjoyed it. But I had to move off that. You know, there was a time where I got representation at a bigger agency in management. I started going on like big auditions, you know, for bigger projects for film and TV at the same time that the offers for DJing started to really roll in, like just started happening. And I had to choose, like, are you going to take these out of town gigs or are you going to try and like do acting stuff? And I took the money on the table because I'm a disc jockey, you know what I'm saying? I'm a DJ.
Yeah.
So,
and you're very good at it. I mean, I think that's something that also in the sense like AM had this very unique thing where he was able to impress and please the true school DJs, know what I mean? As well as the Hollywood people that had no idea why the true school people were like happy, as well as the rich club owner people, as well as everybody somehow, you know? And I think you have that element too, and is why
DJ Graham.
but don't you think that you're able, like a group of DJs can come see you and be very impressed with your musical knowledge, your mixing abilities, your edits you've made, like so many things of your DJ set will be incredible, mind blowing, inspirational
that.
For real. I swear to God. And, as well as the club owner will feel fulfilled that you're doing the exact job they wanted and you're not just trying to impress a group of stupid DJs. The people in the club could be any age or club or event or whatever you're doing, and they will be like, this person is unique and giving us a unique experience and understanding us. So I think that's a hard thing, and that's a well-rounded DJ, and I think, you know, there's not that many people that can do that. And I think you,
I appreciate
AM,
that.
That's why he really shot into the stratosphere for certain aspects. And, you know, of course, then there's the celebrity things and all that. But I think you have that, and it's hard to do. You know, it's hard, and it seems maybe common sense style to you, but from the outside, it is very special and unique.
Why do I have so many haters?
No. I don't think you do.
No, I have some enemies. Trust.
You do? Who are they?
Sure.
Let's call them out.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, you know, I think that that's the sign of, you know, a great DJ and someone that cares about the culture, but also wants to work and make a living and make, you know, can make millions of dollars DJing over time. You know, like I think that you, yeah, that's what you, you know, when I go see you, like I was saying in the beginning of the episode, like when I would go see AM, I would go see Stone Rock, I would go see you, I'd go see Vice and these people. And it really inspired me in a different way where I was like, I didn't know this existed and the ability, you know, I know how to put music together, but I didn't think about it in this. It was just such in the same way the raves were ear and eye opening. So was seeing you guys in that bottle service world, and you really paved the way for everybody, you know, and continue to. And that's what I was saying with your work with both, you know, Bungalow and all the stuff you're still doing.
Yeah. I mean, you're pumping it up versus how it settles in my brain. But
what do you think about it?
I just do what I do. Like I'm dedicated to
right.
it. You know what I mean? I take it. It's like not something to take serious, but it's something to take serious. You know, always like if you're going to go do the gig, you got to take it serious because you've been hired for a job. But like, don't take yourself too serious. I mean, you're playing someone else's jams, you know, and you're playing someone else's songs. Like,
that's a good way to say it. I mean, it is a fine line to it. You're right.
Yeah. So I just go do my thing. And you know, if there's five people or 5,000 people, I'm not going to, you know, I don't take any shorts. You know what I mean? Just because like, that's not what I'm there for.
Right.
And there's been five. You know, I've had to play for five, play for empty rooms plenty of times. Even at like the quote unquote height of open format, guys like me going everywhere and you know, getting a real check. You know, there's plenty of times where you're like, wow, okay. You know,
a lot. Yeah. I've had it in many places.
Yeah, that's like I said, when back in the Red Bull days, I was like, hey, how are your gigs?
Oh, I've definitely DJed in Ann Arbor to like one girl with a hula hoop, you know,
there
or
something. There you go, man. There you go.
But yeah, that's what we learned from. All right. Well, I think it's a good place to end it and then come back on a part two one day.
There's plenty of fun stuff.
There is plenty of fun stuff
to talk about.
But I'm glad you got to come in and tell the stories and tell everyone, you know, give some background on a lot of things. So everyone check him out. Graham Funky, everywhere you can be found, right?
Yeah, you know, I'm not super active on social media. I do my part.
Yeah, you do some things.
Yeah, you know, I do my part.
Yes.
Yeah,
well.
Find me in the club.
Find him in the Insomniac things and all the different things he's doing out there, as humble as he's being. But thank you for everything you've done in the DJ culture and for coming on the show.
No, of course. Thanks for
and being Graham Funky,
you know,
the one and only.
We'll keep doing it.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. It's the DJ Spider podcast presented by BeatSource. Thank you, guys. See you soon. Peace.
Bye.
And that was the DJ Spider podcast.